And if you keep messing around, I'm going to. So if you're looking for trouble, tell you what you do. Come over and get the shit knocked out of you. Now I have always been a peaceful man, but I get hostile if you screw with my plans. Do unto others as you'd like done to you. Believe me, brother, that is the golden rule. I've been through windows, doors, TVs, and chairs, but I never let go, and I pulled out most of their hair. Now I've mellowed a lot since then, so it takes two. Seconds for me to knock the hell right out of you. Oh, I'd love to knock the hell out of you. And if you keep pushing my button, I'm going to. So if you're looking for trouble, tell you what you do. Come over and get some knocked out of you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I know that David Allan Coe thought he had the perfect country and western song. But you don't have to talk about drinking or prison or dying or divorce. All you have to talk about is the basic, deep down human emotions that we all feel inside. That's why this is the perfect country and western song. Cause I'd love to knock the hell right out of you.
Okay, the person that song is dedicated to, he knows who he is. I don't think I'll ever get the chance, but I got him pooping his panties before he even saw me, right? That's okay, though. He likes poop. Hello, this is William Fink, and this is the Chris Degenia Open Forum. It is Monday, November 22nd, 2010. This is an open forum. If anybody wants to speak, I would hope that somebody wants to speak, because I don't have a whole lot to say. Just request talk power, and I'll turn your microphone on when I'm done here. I did want to talk about one thing that sort of weighed on me all day, because I read it in the forum this morning, that a new forum member, had posted a quite long post on thought crimes. He had explained that he was listening to the Two Seed Line series that Eli and I did. And he, I asserted in that Two Seed Line series discussing Genesis chapter 3 that there are no thought crimes in the Bible. And I stand by that. And he questioned it. And he questioned it in this post, citing Matthew 5:28, where Christ says, "But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart." And I'm not going to dispute the words of Christ there. Not at all. And I've probably done that a million times in my own life. So, like most normal men, I'm a sinner. Besides the point, is that a crime? Christ didn't say it was a crime. Let's define a crime. From the American Heritage College Dictionary, 3rd edition. Crime, 1. An act committed, that's the first important definition of a crime. Committed or omitted in violation of law, forbidding or commanding it, and for which punishment is imposed upon conviction. So we see that a crime necessitates an act in the English language. And the second definition is unlawful activity. And the third definition is a serious offense, especially one in violation of morality. It has to be an offense. It has to be something acted on in order to be a crime. A fourth definition, an unjust, senseless, or disgraceful act or condition. So that's the definition of crime, and I could close the dictionary. Let's see what the definition of crime is in the New Testament. And for that, I'm going to read from the Epistle of James, chapter 1, verses 12 through 15. Blessed is the man who endures trial, because being approved, he shall receive the crown of life, which he, meaning Yahweh, promised to those who love him. No one being tried must say that, from Yahweh I am tried. And wasn't that the trial of Job? Job was tried and never blamed God. And for that he was considered righteous. For Yahweh is not able to be tempted by evil, and he tries no one. But each of us, is tried by his own desires, being drawn out and enticed. That lust in your heart Christ was talking about, right? Then the desire, conceiving, gives birth to error or sin, and the error or sin, being accomplished or performed, brings forth death. In other words, in order to really truly be a sin that's punishable, one must act on it. That is a crime. A thought is not a crime. There are no thought crimes in the Bible. Because while there are wicked thoughts, men are not punished for thoughts that are not acted on. Otherwise, we would be punishing ourselves all the time for that. For instance, that carnal song I just played at the beginning of this program, right? That could be considered a thought crime, right? But it's not acted on. And in fact, that song, even if it was acted on for the person it's intended to, that wouldn't by any means be a crime, believe me. But that's just an example. In the Garden of Eden, Eve was punished. And that was my point in the 2C line series. That Eve had to commit an act. The 1C liners in identity, the people that refuse to admit the seed of the serpent, the offspring of the serpent, and the seed or offspring of the woman, those 1C liners, they like to say that Eve committed some kind of thought crime. That's what that clown Ted Wieland asserts, that Eve committed a thought crime. No. Eve was punished, and that necessitates her having committed a wrongful deed. If there's no deed, there's no punishment, according to James, and according to the law. I challenge Ted Whelan to show me one thought crime being punished, or one wicked thought being punished. While Yahweh tries men's hearts and knows the wicked thoughts and the good thoughts, the bad intentions and the good intentions in our hearts, we're only punished under the law for acts actually committed. And that's my answer to Adelphus, and I could probably answer it in three or four sentences when I get around to his post, and I will, but between him and Verbal Vandal, who's a dear friend, Verbal Vandal did answer Adelphus, and I didn't read the results, but it's about 3,000-4,000 words there, and I could have answered it probably in three or four sentences. I will anyway when I get around to it. Hello, Victor.
Yeah, good evening. How are you doing, Bill?
How you doing? I'm going to turn Clifton's microphone on just in case he wants to say something. I hope he wants to say something. Hello, Clifton.
Hello.
How are we doing?
Yeah, I'm here, all right.
Hello. I know that you wrote about that In one of your, I think it was in one of the special notices or to all who deny two seedline, right, about that passage in James about sin and its fulfillment.
Yeah, I wrote about that, but I can't tell you just exactly where. I've written so many things I have to go to the search on my find out where I wrote some of this.
Well, yeah, right. I did write the same shape. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
There's a certain procedure to commit a sin.
But, well, right, and James outlines it. If there's no actual act, then sin is just error, and a thought can be an error, but if there's no act, there's no punishment. There's really no sin, right?
Well, if thought error is a crime, a lot of us in identity are teaching false doctrine. A lot of us are guilty of a crime.
Well, right. And a lot of people in identity teaching false doctrine, I would say, are guilty of crimes. I have a quote somewhere on my website. It does show what Yahweh thinks about those who hold people guilty for their thoughts. And I'm trying to find it right now. And if I'd have thought about it before the program, I'd have dug it out before the program. And my site's too big and I can't find it, but I'll come up with it soon here. So what else is going on tonight? There has to be something else going on tonight. There has to be somebody with something to say.
You know, Bill, I was messing around on the internet this afternoon, and I came across something that I thought was pretty interesting. And, I mean, it's more utilitarian interesting than mind-blowing interesting. There's a Christian, quote-unquote Christian website called Tough Questions Answered, a Christian apologetics blog. And it's more or less Judeo-Christian, neoconservative, but they had a blog entry here, which is a summation of the Family Research Council pamphlet called The Top 10 Myths About Homosexuality. You ever read that? Ever heard of it?
No, I've heard of the Family Research Council.
Sure.
I've heard about the blog, and I think I may have visited it once a year or so ago, but I don't. It surely didn't impress me.
Yeah. Well, it's just so much of what we're told about the quote-unquote gay lifestyle today is just simple BS. We're told they're just like us, and, two daddies or two mommies in the same household's no big deal. And so many of the myths about homosexuality are simply disproven through research. And this pamphlet, I mean, I wouldn't read the whole pamphlet on air because it's pretty lengthy, but it does a good job of destroying a lot of these myths. And I'm gonna throw the link to this blog entry into the chat for anybody who'd like to follow it. There it goes.
Well,
there
from what goes. I've observed all my life, homosexuals are nothing like us. That they are voraciously, I want to say, libidinous. Their libido is in. I mean, they're constantly looking for sex or ways to have sexual gratification. That they're
yeah.
a perverted, twisted people. That whose only joy is in perverting other people and twisting other people into their
yeah.
their sick sensuality.
So and they don't feel so bad about themselves.
Exactly. I have that quote that I was just trying to come up with. It's in Isaiah. It's chapter 29, verses 20 and 21. For the terrible one is brought to naught, this is from the King James, and the scorner is consumed. And this is important. And all that watch for iniquity are cut off, that make a man an offender for a word, and lay a snare for him that reproveth in the gate, and turn aside the just for a thing of naught. Now it's important to understand the Hebrew culture to understand this passage. Him that reproveth in the gate is the person who is upholding Yahweh's laws and informing others of it. Him that reproveth in the gate is the man who says to the homosexual, what you are doing is evil. Repent. And who are the terrible ones and the scorners who watch for iniquity and to make a man an offender for a word. They're the damn Jews trying to pass these hate crime laws so that they can legitimize their perverted, omnisexual beast lifestyles. That's exactly who they are. So Isaiah 29, 20 through 21, that basically contributes to the conversation here, both what I was talking about and what you brought up.
Hey, it fits together. Well, it's not just the homosexual rights advocates. It's anybody who's basically lawless. This is one of the tactics of the lawless ones. Don't speak out against me. You have no right to speak out against me. You've never been in my shoes. Where do you get your moral authority to speak out against me? Well, we get our moral authority from the scripture. So
that's why they campaign so hard to take the scripture out of our lives, and they can't do it. And so they try to change the scripture, exactly. Where sexual deviancy is no longer deviant, basically. Or they're trying to make it not deviant.
Well, I've heard attempts to, in fact, you brought up one the other night, attempts to explain away references to homosexuals in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and New Testament. Well, it doesn't really mean what you think it means. This could mean dogs. It could mean male prostitutes. It could mean this. I've heard it said that the reference in the Mosaic Law to "you shall not lay with a man as a woman" could also mean "you shall not lay with a man in a woman's bed."
That's just sick. That they would go to any length to try to make this say, to try to make this say something other than what it says. It says, "Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind." It is an abomination. Now let me say two things. First, the law is written to men. That's just the way it is. Sorry, women. The law in the Hebrew Bible is written to men. However, it's very obvious that what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right? I mean, that's an age-old adage that's perfectly just. It's written to men, but it applies to women. So if you were a woman, you could read, "Thou shalt not lie with womankind as with mankind." It is an abomination, right? That you could turn that right around because you're a woman. Leviticus 20:13 says, if a man also, and this is specific, if a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination, both men. They shall surely be put to death, their blood shall be upon them. And it's really hard to pervert that, but you're right, they try like hell. And that's, you know, their attack on Paul. When you look at the life of John Spong, like Clifton and I did, this man had a wife, and he had two daughters. And he was kind of he was a bishop of this mainstream Judeo church. He was a civil rights marcher, all right? So he wasn't really normal, right? But he was normal from a mainstream point of view, right? He was a normal guy whose wife got sick. And all of a sudden, when his wife was sick, he had some kind of homosexual epiphany. Fags were bad, and his wife gets sick, and all of a sudden, fags are good because God didn't leave men to dwell alone. And I guess if you can't find a woman, you just take the nearest guy. That became his attitude while his wife was sick. I think that he must have had some sort of weakness, and while his wife was sick, he must have had some kind of physical encounter. And that's what I believe from having read the account, even though he doesn't admit that. But, you know, I like to say that he had a homosexual epiphany while his wife was ill, and I mean that very literally. His wife got sick and he couldn't get a date, so he doubled his chances. That's what I believe. And when he doubled his chances of getting a date, all of a sudden he became a Paul basher. Why did he become a Paul basher? Because Paul is the only figure in the New Testament, and there's no reason to speak out against homosexuality in the Gospel or in the Revelation. But Paul, because his material is an application of the gospel to everyday life, of course, Paul had to address homosexuality and explicitly speaks out against it three times. In Romans and in Galatians and one other epistle, I think it's either Ephesians or Philippians, where he mentions the word arsenokoites explicitly. And arsenokoites basically means coitus or sex among men.
Mm.
And it's used, that same exact word is used over and over again in the profane writers, the secular writers, to describe homosexuality. What we would call today is homosexuality.
Well, it sounds to me, I mean, I'm no expert, but the person you were just talking about, seems to me he probably already had a screw loose to begin with, and it just came a little more unloose with the illness of his wife.
Well, right. I think that all men have weaknesses. I'm not saying that all men have that weakness, right? I think that all men have certain weaknesses and proclivities to cave in under certain amounts of stress in one way or another, and some of us turn to alcohol and some of us to drugs and some of us gamble or do stupid things, but like run off in the Alaskan tundra and try to live with bears. And some of us all of a sudden think we're women. It's crazy, but that's the way I look at it. And I think that also needs an outside influence, and it needs a certain amount of stress or a time of trial and change in one's life. And that's what trials are all about. And we have to learn when we're young that we have to look our trials in the eye so that we overcome them and learn the difference between right and wrong when we're young, and we will overcome them, what with a sound faith. But today, we don't have that foundation anymore.
No, you don't. It's all been kicked out from under us. We don't have the same moral foundation for children that we did when I was a kid in the 70s. And that wasn't as good as it was when my father was a kid in the 40s and the 50s. It's just steadily eroded away. Here's an interesting point in this pamphlet. It says, homosexuals experience considerably higher levels of mental illness and substance abuse than heterosexuals. A detailed review of the research has shown that, quote, no other group of comparable size in society experiences such intense and widespread pathology.
Well, right. They have to have a problem in the first place to be homosexuals.
Yeah.
But if our children had been receiving the firm foundation in Christian education that they did say in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, would we have this incredible number of homosexuals that we have today? I'm sure that we would not.
Well, I think there's always been a secret strain of them running around.
Well, absolutely. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. That they're always
they certainly weren't out in the open. They certainly were not out in the open.
And it was always a very small minority, I believe. And that's part of that's because they weren't out in the open, but part of it is because we had a lot less weakness in society when we had when our children were given a good Christian education, and before right. Your brain is basically. I mean, that television, that screaming electronic Jew in everybody's living room, it's like taking a garden hose and putting it up to your ear and pumping your brain full of feces every day. It's got to have an adverse effect, right, on society, and this is it. Yeah, I mean, we can only take so much Three Stooges and Pee Wee Herman, and I don't know what they watch anymore. I'm sure it's a lot worse than them, but... I just Teletubbies. I mean,
Dances with the Stars and stuff like that.
Yeah, all the garbage. Well, whatever they watch, it's all garbage. And it's created a sick society. That and the social programming that's done in these things, these institutions that pass for schools.
Well, they're not really schools anymore. They're just holding pens until you're old enough to be turned loose on society and responsible for yourself.
Well, basically. Well, Paul mentions arsenokoites twice. It's not. I thought it was in Galatians. It's not. It's in 1 Corinthians 6:9 and 1 Timothy 1:10. And the third time he mentions homosexuality is not explicit, but it's in Romans chapter 1. And if the fags like John Spahn could get rid of Paul, well then that they can they're that much closer to having their deviant lifestyles approved by the church. because Paul was unfair for saying those words. He should have never said those words. And if he said them, he didn't mean it the way we think he meant it. I mean, that's the way they justify their agenda.
Now, here's a question for you. When you read Paul's epistles, is there a surefire method for telling the difference between what is Paul's opinion? And I'm not necessarily saying, well, if it's Paul's opinion, therefore you don't have to follow it. But Paul's opinion and what is directly from Yahweh through Paul.
Well, usually when it's from Yahweh through Paul, he's citing scripture, right? And okay. there's a few times where he explicitly says that it's his opinion, that it's from him and not from God. And that's in 1 Corinthians, where he basically admits not having any scripture to turn on. And that was that's a heavily misunderstood passage, right? It's in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where he tells people that they probably shouldn't marry because of the I forget how the AV words it, the King James words it, but it's something to do with distress. And in my translation, it says because of the present violence. And he's telling these people that they probably shouldn't get married because of the present violence. That if they did choose to get married, they will probably have trial in the flesh. And that's because he was writing that at a time that Christians were being persecuted.
Right.
You know, and it might not be a good idea to start a family if you're a Christian, if you're being persecuted. If you're being fed to the lions, you probably don't want to leave a wife with a pregnant wife behind with a couple of kids hanging from her knees, right?
Yeah,
it only makes sense.
And there's another way of looking at that. That's also an emotional vulnerability. You know, would you be willing to give up Yahshua for your wife?
Right. Well, right. Definitely, you're gonna compromise your faith, right?
Yeah. Compromise. That's what I was looking for. So.
And he admits having no authority for the advice he gives there, because there's no example of those circumstances in the Old Testament. So he basically says, hey, I'm giving my opinion here.
Okay. Bruce, I can't believe you don't have anything to say.
Well, I think that's also where Paul follows that, where he says, I believe that I also have the mind of Christ, or something along that line, that where...
Well, he says, I think that I also have the Spirit of Yahweh, right. And I translate, here's the way I translated 1 Corinthians 7:40. If perhaps then she is happier, so she should remain, according to my opinion. Well, I got to read 7:39 too, because 7:39 is really screwed up in the King James, and I don't read a sentence break where the King James does. And let me read both. Well, I'm going to read both, right? Let me find the King James here. 1 Corinthians 7:39. Now, I could defend the Greek, right? But I don't have to go through each Greek word here. And the King James says, the wife is bound by the law as long as her husband lives, but if her husband is dead, she is at liberty to be married to whom she will, semicolon, only in the Lord, period. New sentence. But if she is happier, if she so abide, after my judgment, and I think also that I have the Spirit of God. Now, that really makes no sense when you read it in the King James. I mean, not to me. And let me read my reading in the Greek from 39. A wife is bound for as long a time as her husband may live. But if perhaps her husband should die, she is free to marry whom she wishes, period. Alone in the prince, if perhaps. Now 40 just started with if perhaps, right? Alone in the prince, or alone in the Lord, if perhaps she is happier, so she should remain, according to my opinion. And I think that I also have the Spirit of Yahweh. So that's what he's saying. He's offering his opinion. And he's saying that if the woman would, if her husband dies, if she would stay alone and serving Yahshua, and if she would be happier that way, then she should stay that way. But he does explicitly state that he's offering his opinion in that case, because there's no Old Testament scripture for him to turn to. And he does that several times in Corinthians.
What was that Greek word that where opinion comes from, Bill?
But, well, the Greek word is nome, G-N-O-M-E. It's the faculty of knowledge, mind, reason, that which is thought or known, one's mind, view, judgment, opinion, mind concerning what ought to be done. I'm giving that definition from, not from Liddell and Scott, which I favor, but from the Enhanced Strong's Lexicon in Bible Works, which is very often fair, and that's a fair translation. That's a fair definition.
I see. No me.
Nome. It's the word that we get know from, K-N-O-W.
That's very interesting.
A lot of English comes from Greek, and we don't even realize it. And that's, to know is one word that comes from Greek, even though they spelt it G-N-O instead of K-N-O. Don't ask me why it's spelled K-N-O in English.
Why is it spelled K-N-O in English? I'm just joking.
I don't know. John, how you doing? Long time no hear. He asked to be able to talk and his microphone's muted. Kaiser, ground control to Kaiser. Come in, Kaiser.
No, he muted his speakers. He's not listening.
Oh, his mic's on and his speakers are muted. He should go to Hades for that one. I'm sorry. Hello, John.
Oh, sorry, I was just watching that video.
Okay. What's going on?
Not much. Didn't feel well today, but I'm feeling better now.
Good. I mean, you've been here sometimes, but you usually come late and then you fall asleep, right?
Well, I fall asleep before that and after that.
So how's it going? Was anything you want to talk about? Anything in particular? I heard you type in the question what the topic was, but I mean the topic was short tonight. So,
well, in a recent show you mentioned with Eli about the Arian heresy of how they viewed Christ as a separate being. How did that come about? Did you do any study on it?
No. Yeah, you know, it's attributed to some Egyptian named Arius, but I don't really. I don't really see that, and no, I haven't done any in-depth study on it. But the Arian heresy is—it's not Arian because it's Germanic or Indo-European, right? It's Arian because the belief is that the doctrine, whatever you want to call it, is attributed to an Egyptian named Arius. So they call it the Arian heresy.
All right, so he was just some guy on a sect then.
But I'm not really positive he's the initiator of it, right? I would look at that skeptically until I actually examined it, and I haven't had the chance.
So, I mean, it came about for a reason, though. I mean, and it's similar with today's Jehovah's Witnesses, I think.
Well, for the most part, the traditionalist Judahites, or the Pharisees and Sadducees, however you want to look at it, they had a real hard time believing that Christ could be God. They had a real hard time believing their own scriptures. So I could see that, and even we see it somewhere, sometimes in the New Testament, that was disputed at that time. I mean, there's no doubt that it's not probably the single oldest dispute in Christianity.
Right. Well, let me ask you about the when the Spirit descended upon Christ, what did that signify? I mean, that the beginning of his ministry, or is that all?
Well, right. I believe that signified the beginning of his ministry, and it was a sign for us. It's not anything that really he needed.
Well, I mean, before then, what was he? He was a man, but
he was still Yahweh in the flesh,
without knowing he was.
Of course, he knew he was.
Oh, right. He said, when I was 12 years old, he said, I'm in the house of my father, right?
Right. And that he had his father's work to do. We have God the Son and we have God the Father, but they're both Yahweh. We have God the Holy Spirit. It's all three are natures of the same God. WCB, Christ did have brothers and sisters. They were born after him. He had several brothers and sisters, but they were born after him. Yeah, you know, it's a very Catholic belief that Mary was an eternal virgin, and she's still a virgin. You'll never convince the Catholics that, of anything otherwise.
You know, Bill, I dated a Catholic woman once, and, you know, I told her, I said, look, I can't be a part of this because it's against the scriptures. And I pointed it out to her, and she just didn't, I said, Christ had brothers and sisters. I mean, it quite clearly says that.
Right. You know, when his brethren, he was told, your brothers and sisters are outside the door looking for you. Yeah, you know, they like to say that word brother is a spiritual brother. We're all brothers. Well, then, what would be the point of making the statement? Yet, you know, in the context of your mother and brothers and sisters, what would be the point about making the statement if they were all his brothers and sisters? It makes no sense at all to word it that way. Of course, they were his actual, literal, physical brothers and sisters. What was his actual, literal, physical mother? But he said instead, and it's correct. I mean, we can't dispute with Christ anyway. But I can fully agree with the concept, and have no problem accepting it. That those, meaning those of the children of Israel, who do the will of my Father, they are my mothers and brothers and sisters. In other words, my fellow racial kinsmen that does the will of my God is closer to me than my own brother by the same parents who doesn't do his will. That's all he's saying. And since we're all Adamic Israelites are ultimately derived from the same original parents anyway, that then we are all like brethren, right? But yeah, that they have to be his literal brothers and sisters outside that door with his mother. In that context, it's totally intellectually dishonest to read it otherwise.
Right, and at the beginning of the, I think, the Matthew, it says that Joseph didn't know her until after Christ was born.
Right, absolutely. She wasn't a perpetual virgin. That is a Catholic idea that is just wrong. And most Catholic ideas are wrong because they haven't read the Bible. And if they have, they purposely bury what they disagree with. It's always church opinion. They're no better than the rabbis. The rabbis actually believe that they can overrule God and in their own writings, in the Talmud, take precedence over the Torah. Well, the Catholics are no damn different.
That's their spirit.
The Catholics are no different.
Well, I mean, in the case of the Jews, that's they're emulating their father's spirit.
Well, they absolutely are. But I think that a lot of those Catholic popes and bishops are right there with the Jews. That's why they wear yarmulkes. There's certainly no better.
It seems like it also feminizes the attempts to feminize Christ in the sense of ascribing the worship virgin. I think they called it virgin worship, where they worship the fertility goddess in all the Canaanite, a lot of the Canaanite lands, and the Canaanites, they had this
right. That's his oldest time, right? Mm-hmm. And lustful men have worshipped virgins for since the dawn of time, and I've watched the Mexicans and the Puerto Ricans and the Cubans up close and personal. And if you took that virgin and that baby out of the Catholic religion, they would lose every Latino and Hispanic tomorrow. That they would lose Mexico and all of South America and the Caribbean Catholic Church. That they would leave the church immediately.
Well, I mean, they bow down in front of these. I've seen them do it too. They bow down in front of these statues.
Yeah, right. But I mean, the Mexicans especially, they really worship that virgin. They love those pictures. I've seen them fawning over those pictures of that nice, white, pure virgin for hours at a time. I never believed it if I didn't see it myself.
That reminds me of that cartoon where a Muslim suicide bomber winds up in their Muslim heaven and Allah says, oh, we're all out of virgins.
Well, right, but you know, there's people in Christian identity who think that when they get to the kingdom of God, they're going to have 20 wives, too. They may as well be Muslims.
Yeah.
Some of them come right here to this room. I'm not mentioning any names.
Well, you know, why is it that we give such great importance to sex, and sex comes in, I mean, there's nothing wrong with sex. I mean, a natural affection for a man and a woman, but why is it we give it such great importance in the worldly sense, what the Jew promotes? Because in that we're absolutely free. We feel free, right? What we forget about ourselves completely, no matter what type of escape it is, and that's why we've made it the most important thing, is because we can forget about ourselves and really feel free, right? But then we're back to us again, right?
Well, let me tell you something. The only times in my life I ever thought that I could forget about myself and really feel free, I had a trout line in my hand and I was on a boat in the middle of a lake somewhere at 6 a.m. And even that didn't last more than 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah, same here on the Feather River. That with that 6-foot salmon that got away, you know.
Well, yeah, it's... a lot of people think that heaven is sexual fulfillment, right? And those people, most of them are probably going to hell. If that's, a good sexual relationship with a good woman even transcends sex, right? And that's all great and well and good, and Yahweh meant for us to have partners like that. However, that's not life. I mean, it's nice, but it's not life. And that's not, it sure as hell isn't the kingdom of heaven.
A cow chews its cud and constantly chews the cud. So a stupefied mind. And in our youth, if we're honest, some of us had, done a lot of chewing, while we're young. Because you get the excitability of the senses and all that. This pornography being pushed by the Eskimos, the Jews, it's just horrendous. Kids have to, the promotion of it by their parents and their siblings, and it's really quite insane.
Well, what else do we have tonight? You got to have something else. Come on, there's 20 people here. I have to want to say something.
Well, I was just going to make something amusing remark about growing up with Christ as his older, your older brother. I mean, what could have that been like?
Well, it was evident during his ministry that they rejected him. They probably thought he was some kind of nut. We always think prodigies are a little weird, right? I think they got it after his resurrection. They understood it finally, because a lot of them became apostles. Jude and James, the elder James, are the brethren of Christ. No doubt. From my reading of the scriptures, Jude, of the author of the epistle, and James, the author of the epistle, after the respective names, that they are the brethren of Christ.
So, they came to believe then.
Well, yeah, but they didn't believe it until it happened, and that's very that's very much like our race in every respect. A lot of times, even when marvelous things did happen, our ancestors didn't believe it, or the next day they would forget about it and go on their merry way. But we have such short memories. We have this marvelous thing, this brain, and we like to forget some things as quickly as possible, right? It's incredible the things we can forget when we want to.
No, I'm saying, like, growing up with him as your older brother, you must have noticed his behavior, and it must have been perfect then.
I'm sorry. Your behavior must have been perfect.
No, Bright's behavior must have been perfect. They must have noticed that.
Well, I'm certain it probably was.
Probably?
Well, yeah. I don't have records. I can't see if he never did anything that a normal young boy would do, right? I mean, There was one point when he was 13 where he was kind of rebellious towards his parents at age 12, right? Is that perfect behavior? Even for the will of God, right?
Well, he did tell his mom parents that he would be in the house of his father, and that's exactly where he went. I mean, that wasn't really rebellious.
No, he didn't tell them ahead of time where he was going to be.
Well, I thought that's what he said to her.
They looked all over for him and couldn't find him, remember? That they thought, they took it for granted that he would be on the road with them, and that they went on a journey home and realized that he wasn't with them.
I believe that when they finally found him in the synagogue speaking to the elders, that he told them, didn't I not tell you that I wasn't going to be in the house of my father?
You know something? I don't think he put it that way. And I don't know what... That's such a general story. I don't know how I would find...
Yeah, I don't know where it is either.
Let me search for 12.
It's in Luke.
Shows when he was 12. No, it's not. When he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And when they had fulfilled the days as they returned, the child Jesus tarried behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother knew not of it. But they supposing him to have been in the company of people with them, went a day's journey. Now that's a long walk, that's probably about 20 miles, right? Went a day's journey, and they sought him among their kinsfolk and acquaintance. The whole village would have traveled together, right? And when they found him not, they turned back again to Jerusalem, seeking him. And it came to pass that after 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the doctors. That's actually the Greek word for teachers. Both hearing them and asking them questions. And all that heard him were astonished at his answering and answers. And when they saw him, they were amazed. And his mother said unto him, Son, why have you dealt thus with us? Behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. They thought they lost him, right? And he said to them, How is it that you sought me? Wist ye not that I must be about my... In other words, do you not know that I must be about my father's business? That could be interpreted today as back talk to a parent, right? And that's all I'm trying to say. But was his behavior... Do we know that his behavior was perfect in... From our perspective, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah, you know what I mean? Because we would have different expectations than God would.
Right, well, it was perfect that he did not sin.
Well, right, absolutely. That's absolute. That's an absolute.
Well, that's a good point. You mentioned in the beginning of the opening of the Christogenia Forum is the fact that the thought crime, if thinking... Or being tempted was a crime. I mean, then, you know, Christ sinned. But, I mean, to say that Christ could never have sinned, he could have blown the whole thing. You know what I mean?
Well, right. And he had to be spotless. He had to be blameless. There's no doubt. There's no doubt that he was.
And he is obviously grievously tempted, you know.
Absolutely, and I'm sure even, you know, even God, every thought must go through his mind. Do you see what I mean?
Uh-huh.
The way I look at it is we might think of two or three or four possibilities, and some of those are wrong to do, right? So we would consider them sinful. We don't act on it, so it's not really a crime, right? But Yahweh himself... Every possibility must go through his mind instantly, and long before the event took place, right? That's what I would think. So there can't be any thought crimes, right?
All knowing.
Right.
Well, I mean, Jesus did say that even if you think of a woman with lust in your heart.
Well, John, you missed the first 30 minutes of this presentation tonight.
Sorry about that.
And you should really go back and listen to it when it's posted.
Will do.
I talked about that exact thing. And read, go to my translation and read James chapter 1, verses 12 to 15. I read them tonight. I read them the first part of this program. You know, to have the thought is wrong, but if you don't act on the thought, there's no crime, there's no punishment. And that's sin, right? That's the fulfillment of sin. It requires an act that needs to be punished because it's a wrongful deed.
Well, I mean, did he say that? He did say that you committed adultery in your heart, which means that you have committed a sin.
Well, right, but it's not a punishable crime. There's a difference. There's no such thing as a thought crime was the theme of the first 20 minutes, perhaps, of this program. Yeah, of course there are wicked thoughts, but we can't act on them, or we are criminals. And you might like the connection there with the song I played to introduce the program to, but I won't give it away, so you'll have to go listen.
It's a prize.
Is it just punishment?
It's really. I'm aghast and very surprised and astonished at how the so-called world's education doesn't. We don't even talk about what thinking and thought are, you know? I mean, it's like some big mystery that I'm not talking about, you know, psychological philosophy and some kind of, you know, analytical technique or all this knowledge of, you know, what is dissecting every little thought. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what is thinking. I mean, that's a subject we should teach our children in school.
Well, schools today teach our children what to think, not how to think. We haven't taught kids how to think in I don't know how many years. It's at least 50. It's probably longer than that.
No, you know, it's what to feel, you know. You know, you got to feel good, Bill.
A classical education, which means the Bible and the classics and real mathematics and hard science, all of that taught kids how to think. Latin and Greek at a young age, or Latin or Greek, or at least Latin, right? And all of that taught kids how to think. We don't teach kids how to think anymore.
And so that it could be very, one could live a very ordered life, you know. And not use thought where it has no place and use it where it's absolutely necessary. But where it's not necessary, where it's destructive, we avoid it. We see that it's like a dangerous animal and stay away from it. That's all. It's not complicated. But we complicate everything. I'm using strong language, not an accusation. Please understand.
Well, if anybody wants to talk, just right-click your own name and request talk power, and I'll turn your microphone on. But this is an open forum. We can't have an open forum without participants. Not that you guys aren't doing bad. I just like to like to keep it rolling along, right?
You know, I have here a book, The Funeral Home That Buried My Dad. Gave me this book, and apparently they give it to every family. It's called Lift Up Thine Eyes in the Memory of Whoever It Is That Dies. And what it is, it's just a bunch of, it's comforting, you know, to the family of the loved one. But what I thought, I forgot about this book, and I found it today when I was looking for something else. And it is filled with biblical-themed paintings from Europe, different artists, say from the 14th century on up to the 19th
century. Right, when they painted the good stuff, right?
Yeah, okay. Well, the interesting thing is, I'm going to sit down one day and I'm going to look up some of these artists, like Franz Franck, okay, Abraham and the Three Angels from Genesis 18 and 12. This is painted by Franz Franck.
And bet it wasn't one white, one black, and one Chinese, right?
No, as a matter of fact, it's a blonde, a brunette, and a red-headed angel.
Real diversity, right?
Yeah. And Abraham's on the ground, and he looks like a white guy with long blonde hair.
But, well, of course.
I'm going to find these paintings, and I'm going to start a thread on the forum. And just, what I was going to get to was when you got to people artists from the Mediterranean, they tended to put darker people in these paintings, but not everyone in the painting was dark or maybe had a hook nose. Some of these Italians and Spaniards tended to slip some hook-nosed people into their paintings. Oh, good God, there's one. And Joseph explains his dreams to the Pharaoh. Joseph looks like a rake from the 16th century.
Well, it shows you the tendency that everybody wants to make God and the patriarchs in their image, right?
In their own image, yeah. But it's just kind of cool to look at, Moses saved from the waters of the Nile, and everybody in the painting is Western European. I'm going to find some of these paintings online. Here's Meeting of David and Abigail from 1 Samuel 25. David looks like the redneck who lives down the road from me. curly blonde hair and a heavy beard, But I'm going to find some of these paintings and start a thread. I don't know, maybe tomorrow if I can find the time.
Yeah, sure. If you make some decent scans of them, I might use some of them. I'm looking for more artwork.
I could scan them, but these are all public works, so I'm sure I could find them on the Internet. So just type up the names, like The Good Samaritan by Jean von Skorl.
You will probably find most of them on the Internet.
Sure. Some of these I've seen before in other places. I may do that tomorrow.
Well, and I noticed even in... Caps, who was it? Mr. Caps, who made the Birth of a Nation video. If you watch that, you'll notice some of the pictures he puts are darker folks, as Israelites, and he's talking about Israel identity.
Yeah, right. Caps seemed to be lost to it. I don't know. Yeah, right. I would have. I always wondered why he compromised on that. Did do that. I wondered if he did that. I don't think he did it on purpose. I think he may have been working with the artwork that he had, but he should have used something else. And that's Creation of a Nation. I have that somewhere on Christgania. I didn't mean to cut you off. I knew exactly what you were talking about
when you mentioned it.
Yeah, Creation of a Nation. I'm sorry. The Birth of the Nation is, I think that's the... about the KKK in the early 1900s or something.
Yeah, that's on Christogenia also.
Yeah.
I host that video also. Stole it from somewhere, I forget where. But yeah, that's not E. Raymond Capt. I'm trying to think of his name now. He was probably the last good director we had in Hollywood. And it's lost on me.
I'm quite certain that crash in the 20s is when the Jews swallowed and bought up all of the mainstream Hollywood channels. I regret that I haven't listened to your speaking about Wilhelm Marr.
Thank you, Paul. I just found it on my site. Birth of a Nation is D.W. Griffith. Hello, Paul, too. Welcome to Christogenia, Christogenia.net. I'm sorry, Bruce.
Oh, I think you had done a talk about Wilhelm Marr.
Yes, we have one more segment of that left, but it was more contentious than I thought it would be.
Oh.
It's good to see how old some of those beliefs that these white nationalists of today hold, right?
Yeah, there's nothing new under the sun, right?
No, absolutely not. And Wilhelm Marr suffered the same disease that white nationalists do today, that Christianity is Jewish is a farce. Christianity is the antithesis of Judaism.
Oh, yes. Well, and Judaism will try to go around the main gate, come in the back door, like that statement about the Paul speaking about it's better for you, I think it's my opinion, to, remain as a bride of Christ and, so it doesn't cause more trouble. Well, what the Jew will do is say, see, that's from the Jew, because they want to exterminate white folks, right? And that's the argument that those create retards brought about.
Yeah, there's a lot of straw man arguments and false arguments in the modern dialogue concerning Christianity.
Oh, yeah.
And most of that, again, is that Well, we have no more solid Christian education in our youth. And it's gone. And it, there was never a real solid Christian education in most of our schools in the first place, but because it was the false Christianity of the Catholics or whatever other sect was teaching it. But it's a lot better than no Christian education, that's for sure. But we'd at least have a moral backbone in this nation, even with a Catholic education.
Oh, yes. But I would dare venture to say, even with a Judeo-Christian education, Judeo-Christians are just totally, there's something in their brain that's just, it's not working. It went over the edge.
WCB, what's going on?
Oh, man, it's tough. I was basically trying to convince Brian to let someone get interviewed, and he got pissed. He threw a little hissy fit, and he left. I'm kind of surprised how upset he got. That's about it, and we're just talking about like if we should get involved in the whole secular politics.
Well, you know, when we interviewed Kevin McDonald last year, I knew he was an atheist, but I wanted to... I felt at the time that the Frankfurt School discourse was much more important than his atheism, so I didn't beat him over the head with his religion, right?
Exactly.
Perhaps Lord Brethren overreacted and probably missed an opportunity to talk to a white nationalist. And
it's not that bad. I mean, at least he's a Mormon, but still, at least he believes in God, you know.
Yeah, right. Mormons have all sorts of problems. I don't know if we get anywhere with a white nationalist Mormon. I'd rather talk to a white nationalist atheist, to be honest with you. But Mormons can be pretty eccentric about their faith, from my personal experience. And it's a strange one, too.
Yeah, I imagine.
Well, that book is crap. I mean, I've perused the Book of Mormon, and it's out there.
Just look at that video you have on Lathobolos.
Right.
And looking at it the other day.
Really? And I can't accept that Mormons are Christians. That they're not. They're not Christians at all. There's something, some other weird, strange, I don't know, hybrid Judeo UFO cult or something. I don't know. It's I don't know how to describe it.
You know, back several years ago when I was still in the Methodist Church, the Mormon, the main LDS branch sent some representatives to our general conference up in Tennessee wanting to know if the UMC would accept the Mormon baptism. Because there are certain types of baptism the UMC will not accept a transfer on, and the Mormons are one of them. And, of course, the Methodist Council of Bishops said, well, we'll accept yours if you accept ours. And no, Mormons wouldn't have any part of that because, you know, they don't have any control over that. So pop goes that little conversation. They really are cult-like.
The truth is that the whole baptism thing is just crazy. But it's incredible how much they police that baptism ritual. It has to be a full body dunk, a forward dunk, a splash of water on the forehead isn't good enough. That's just nuts the way they argue over that. And the whole thing is vain to begin with. It's just a ritual.
Yeah.
I just every time I think about how they treat that baptism ritual, I just have to laugh. Now, Pete Peters has told people, if you're not baptized by me, you're not going into the kingdom of heaven. People, Clifton could tell you, people have flown across the country to get baptized by Pete Peters, believing that they wouldn't get to heaven unless Pete Peters baptized them. I've seen people get re-baptized because they thought they were baptized, somebody told them they were baptized the wrong way. It has to be a forward dunk or a full-body immersion. It can't be in a tub, it has to be in a river, or this, that, and the other. It's just crazy the way these false pastors just seek to rule over other people's faith.
Well, even if you are into baptism, baptism is a Greek word that was not translated into English for the authorized version, and it means immersed, if I remember correctly.
Well, yes, it does. To baptize means to immerse.
Well, I got christened as a baby, so I didn't have any say-so in it.
Well, you know something? I wrote in my baptism in what paper that christening is actually... the christening with a splash of water on the head, that is actually from a pagan German name fastening ceremony. It's mentioned in the Edas.
Huh.
It's in baptism in what on Christogenia? It's not in the version that Clifton had originally circulated as a pamphlet, because I wrote that paragraph in later. I found the reference after I originally wrote the paper. It's a Germanic name fastening ceremony. That's what a christening is.
And
the Germans wouldn't stop doing it, so the Catholics said, okay, we'll call that baptism. That's the way I look at it anyway. Okay, if anybody wants to talk, just right-click your name and click Request Talk Power.
Yeah, Bill, I think I was going along the same lines as you. I was hoping we'd talk on what we can agree on first. And if he has any questions about PI, he can ask us. But, I don't think he's going to beat us over the head with Mormonism, because that's not his goal. Like, he's, I think, politics first. That's the kind of vibe I got from him from reading his article.
Well, I believe that we don't have any political solution, period, but I think the A3P party should even realize that, right?
Yeah, that's what I was saying in the chat. Like, it's not going to solve our problems, but it's a platform to raise awareness. And where there's awareness and Christianity, we can always pop in.
Well, you know, Vircato, I saw what you wrote about baptism, that you were baptized in the River Jordan and got an infection. That is funny, but I'm sorry to hear it happen to you. I really am. Yes, Yahweh does have a sense of humor. He sits up in heaven and laughs at all of us. Yeah, WCB, the Tea Party's the same way. You know, a lot of identity people were going to these Tea Party things, and I had discussed with several of them that it's really, that there's no hope in Tea Parties, right? It's ridiculous. But you're going there meeting people that are looking for something, and it's a good time to try to encounter like-minded people and possibly steer them into Christian identity or into what we believe, right?
Precisely.
Yeah, go there with some signs that say the Jews did 9/11 and see what happens.
Yeah, right. And they'll probably be throwing tomatoes at you, I'm sure. But if you go there with and talk to people rationally and hand out 9/11 missing links DVDs or Clifton Emmaheiser pamphlets, you might get somewhere.
Yep, the velvet glove.
Or kick the Jew off the platform.
Well, that's, yeah, you know, it's a good way to find people that are looking. It functions like that. But I certainly wouldn't go there expecting any salvation from any political movement, especially one that the Jews have already usurped, right? It's just not going to happen. Our salvation does not lie in politics.
Bill, I have a question about how you're treating kinsmen who are either Odinists or atheists or something. How do you treat them, even though they may not be aware of the word? How would you treat them?
How would I treat? Yeah, you know, I spent half my prison time arguing with Odinists, or even hang out. I would rather hang out with Odinists in prison than with white guys that like niggers, right? I mean, I'm just being frank. That's the way it is, because at least they're racially conscious. And that gets them about halfway there. But I have always, and in all my debates with all the Odinists, and I mean some pretty intelligent guys that I've met, none of them could ever debate on me with about history, about the origin of our language, or anything else that would support the identity story. But they all got hung up on one thing: morals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my experience. They can't get over the fact that there are moral rights and moral wrongs, and that to cross the line is sin, and we should be judgmental about that and not approve it in any way. That they are all they all had moral problems. They wanted their little Chinese girls. They wanted all the flings they could. They wanted to get, you know, that they want to sleep around and slut around and drink and drugs. And that's the way they live life. And they don't want anybody telling them that that's wrong.
Right. Now, see, I take it from an approach that these people are not aware. And even I kind of have to criticize some CI people that I've seen on forums. They want to berate these people and in the most harshest terms, and without even preaching to them properly first. And I think that's wrong.
Well, you're right. We don't know the Odinist what he's heard in his life, and he has to be shown humbly and upfront that there's another way, and that Christianity should indeed be the true religion of our race and is the historic religion of our race, right? And that can be argued very effectively by many people in identity, and that's why, and that's the approach that I would have up front with these Odinists. And I would challenge them to show me the basis for what they believe, because it's only extrapolated from a few ancient poems, but those poems themselves, they don't codify any worship of Odin or any particular belief system, except where it happens to be very much like the Hebrew. In other words, Odin, the word Odin means, it is the same word as the word Adon, a Hebrew word which means Lord. Odin is Adon, no matter how you slice and dice it. Now, the Germanic Eddas, or the Icelandic Eddas, however you want to say it, they considered Odin to be the All-Father. So the Lord is the All-Father. Well, Yahweh, our God, is our Lord and our Father. In other words, there are a lot of parallels between Odinism and Hebrewism. Now, if you take those parallels out of Odinism, what you have left is a bunch of stories about some old dead white men. You don't have really anything left.
Well, as far as the Jews are concerned now with these people, it says they are racially aware, but in their, I'd say their principles, it's therefore their kinsmen. But does that really make them racially aware?
Well, all the Odinists that I knew were pretty much racially aware, that they would only hang out or commune with other whites.
Yeah, but
in prison, that's pretty much what you want to do, though, unless you're a fag or a whore.
Well, yeah, of course. But as far as not being in prison or anything, just out in the field. Now,
I never knew any Odinists outside of prison. I'm being honest. I'm sorry to cut you off. I never knew any Odinists outside of prison, except RV Wolfpack, the guy I pitched out on ProThings forum that thing.
But you said it was no protection for them against the Jews.
No. No, it's definitely not. And I've never... They think it is? Well, when was... What kind of time did the Jews have in pagan Rome? What kind of time did the Jews have in Persia with the Parthians? And in Mesopotamia? And everywhere they found pagans. The Jews never had a problem infiltrating them, taking their women, selling them as sex whores, gambling, booze, and race mixing and everything else that Jews do. Money lending, usury, everything else that Jews do. The Jews had a ball in pagan Rome. The Jews had a ball in pagan Greece. The Jews had a ball in pagan Spain.
Agreed.
When Christianity came and told the Jew, you can't do this, you can't do that, and you can't do that, the Jew had to pack up and leave.
And organize the Arab invasions.
Right, exactly. And the Turkic invasions, they were organized by Jews and Arabs.
And it's in their damn blood even to this day.
No, paganism was never any defense against the Jew. And I could demonstrate from the pages of, I'm sorry, I forget if it's Livy or if it's Diodorus Siculus. That Caesar, I think it's Diodorus Siculus. I could go upstairs and check my notes. That Caesar had a Canaanite teacher, except that the writer thought that Canaanite was a town in Palestine, right? Canaan. I swear, I could point it out. So the Jews were there. They were in Rome, those Canaanites. I could establish that. It's only from one passage in one writer, but it's an awfully striking passage. The Jews had money lending back to the 3rd, 4th century BC. Livy writes about the problems that the Romans had with money lending. he doesn't attribute it to any alien alien nation, but they did have that problem.
Bill, do you think that the apostles knew the let's say the Edomites and the Canaanites at that time, that they were tares?
Well, they tried to get rid of the Canaanite woman because she was a dog, right? I mean, they tried to tell her to beat it. They were telling her to get lost. Christ didn't admonish them for it. Hardly anything you do to a prospective Christian.
Right. Did they actually think that she was one of the tares, though?
Well, you know something? Yeah. They knew she wasn't acceptable for some reason, right? They knew she was an alien and she wasn't acceptable. They knew that much. You could tell that from the account.
Right.
They may not have known why. They probably didn't know why. I mean, Matthew knew she was a Canaanite. He wrote it. So Matthew knew. But the rest of them may not have known why, but they knew that she was no good. They wanted to, hey, beat it. Get out of here. They knew. They were trying to run her off.
Well, yeah, Yahweh did say in the scriptures that there's something morally depraved about these people.
Well, you know, in the traditional Jewish Christian Judaism or Judeo Christianity, they actually promulgate that we all come from the same bloodline, and so they teach us all that we're all children of Cain and Adam, you know, and that's kind of like the real mentality of Judeo Christianity is that. That we all come from the same father, you know. And it's a hard truth and fact to face that there are sheep and goats, and that getting past that is you got to pull out the sympathy cards and throw them away. I mean, it's a hard fact to face, but as far as those odinists, you know, yeah, you met RV, didn't you, John?
Yeah, I've met him on a couple occasions. He's a volatile character.
I'd like to meet RV someday. I'd like to see what he got to say to me.
Hey, bitch. Where's my bitch?
Right, Bob. Kuwait lipstick. Virkato, yeah, you know, the apostles were raised, and this is clear from Josephus, right? Because Josephus, this problem is very clear throughout his history. The apostles were raised to accept the Edomites as Judeans, and they did so. Judas Iscariot, even though he was an Edomite, he was circumcised, and they were raised to accept them as Judeans. Right or wrong, that's the way they were raised.
Which shows that he must have looked like them, very similar. He must have had, a lot of racial white blood in him.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they did. Yes, we have been raised the same way in this society. And most, you know, I don't know how many white guys I ran into in my life that thought that so many people of mixed blood and Jews and Sicilians, oh, he's white, he's all right. Guy's got his knuckles dragging on the ground and a jaw bigger than a basketball. And
well, they say the same thing about people of completely other races too.
I knew two mm-hmm. Sicilians in my life that knew that they weren't white, and they were both Sicilians. I mean, when you looked at them, you knew they were Sicilians. I mean, dark as hell and. The frizzy hair or whatever, very close to being an afro, but not quite, you know. One of them was a mobster, and the other one was a corrections captain, and he was one of my supervisors at one time. And he said to me, you know, one day we were in a car on a corner, and there were five or six Negroes standing on the corner. And he looked at him, and he shaking his head no, and he said to me, Billy, I'm telling you what, I know I got some of that in me, but I hate them. I just hate them. I can't do anything about it, but I could hate them. I'll never forget that.
It's funny how he thinks that way, though. I mean, I don't know what that signifies.
Well, right. You're absolutely right. I'm not going to claim to know what it signifies anyway, but he did think that way. And I knew the man for 20 years, and he basically consistently thought that way.
Well, were there really it could have been Nubians in Sicily.
Well, there were definitely Arabs in Sicily. I mean, if you read the Saxon Chronicles, you'll read about King Edward's pilgrimage to Jerusalem and how he was entertained by Arab sheikhs in Sicily.
Yeah, also, the Arabs brought oranges to Sicily from China, from the Oriental trade. That's why they grow oranges in Sicily now.
Yeah, you can have my sister.
But, Richard the Lionhearted tried to give his sister to an Arab. I'll never understand that one.
That's gross.
That's those damn French for you. Actually, I think
he
was English. That's right. I'm sorry. He was English, too. Oh, well.
Well, Bill, I mean, was it at that time were the so-called Arabs, or maybe a Saladin was maybe not an Arab, per se?
You know something, from where he comes from and from his the little I know about him in history, because I'm really not a student of the Middle Ages, right? I'm going to admit that. I always do. But it's hard to imagine that he wasn't an Arab. I mean, I guess it's possible, but it's hard to imagine. It's really hard to imagine that he wasn't an Arab.
Well, you know, I just recalled something you did on a show with Daniel, saying that giving away his sister, that ruined her.
Right.
So if it ruined her, he must have been an Arab.
Well, if that prophecy is talking about Richard the Lionhearted, right? I mean, I think it is, but I can't say that with, and I didn't say it with 100% certainty when I said it. But it matches up pretty damn good, I thought. Daniel 11 is just a very difficult chapter to figure out the fulfillment of. And I don't think I'm ever going to have it 100%.
And Daniel 12 is indecipherable at this point.
But you know something? I've thought about it. And let me read Daniel 12, right? And there's still a couple of things I got to check out here. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never since there was a nation, even unto that time. Yeah, you know, everybody thinks this Michael is a savior. He's not a savior. When Michael stands up, that precipitates a time of trouble. I haven't figured out if Michael is Kaiser Wilhelm or Adolf Hitler, but that's where my thinking is leading me.
I thought it was an angel.
It's a prophecy. It's an allegory. Yes, Michael is an angel. But here, Michael represents somebody, a figure in history. Michael's called here a great prince, not an angel.
Well, probably Michael good. Means who is like God.
Right, it does.
I remember.
But what we've, you see, somebody said something that made me realize that, right? Somebody said that the Germans use that name Michael like we use John Doe. And that's what I need to investigate. And if that's true, then I'm certain my translation, my interpretation is correct.
Well, Joseph Goebbels, when he was a student in the university, wrote a novel called Michael. And if I recall correctly, it was supposed to be a sort of everyman sort of character.
And right, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's the interpretation I'm leaning towards. That might seem out there because it's so contrary to everything else you've heard in Christianity. But it's not. It's not the first time I've done that. So, okay. If anybody wants to talk, right click your name and ask that your microphone be turned on. Opacat TM won't accept anything I ever say. It don't matter. It could be black and white right in front of his face. He won't accept it.
So, why don't Jews believe in the Old Testament? I mean, the New Testament.
Why don't Jews believe in the New Testament? Because they're not the people of the Old Testament. Real simple.
Yeah, I was going for that too, but I wasn't sure if you were going to say that.
If they were a sheep, they'd have heard his voice. They don't hear his voice because they're not a sheep.
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty explicit.
There was this one whining about it to my friend. She's like, oh my God. Someone asked me to join Bible study course. I can't believe my school has a Bible study, first of all. That just blew my mind. And she says, oh, I only believe in the Torah. I don't believe in the New Testament. And I was like, why? And she says, well, because the Messiah hasn't come yet. And like, I just wanted to say, well, yeah, he hasn't come for you. But I didn't want to start with that.
Well, yeah, right. But he's coming for her soon. And she'll be converted. She'll be converted with the rest of them. How many Jews can fit in a Volkswagen?
Don't worry, girl. He's coming for you soon. I never thought about that. That's true.
Hello, Gerald.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Am I coming across okay right now?
Well, yeah, Gerald, but I'd like...
Previous conversation.
All right, Gerald, you're talking is better than you're listening, but you're sounding fine.
Oh. Well, I thought I was listening pretty good. I almost fell asleep. Not because of any of y'all.
Wow.
So I wanted to jump back to a little previous conversation earlier. Yeah. You know, growing up during the 60s and being active on, I discovered something that WCB was talking about and y'all was talking about that, you know, we have to reach out to other people other than just already CI conscious people, because there are a lot of Jacob Israel people out there who are blinded and do not know and are susceptible to the truth. And unfortunately, you know, we can't just hit them with everything automatically. We've got to hit them, their babe, to bring them on with the milk, and then slip them some meat until they catch on. But, you know, there have been a lot of people. Commander George Lincoln Rockwell said it rather well when they asked him why he went out and went after the white thugs out on the street to join his movement. And he said, well, he said, number one, they were susceptible. They had time and energy on their hands. And he said that their minds could be molded. And I think that's a lot of what the National Socialists in Germany did, because there were a lot of people who just simply were not aware of the truth. I think that's one of our missions. Like on the Talk Show program and others, we brought in a lot of people to CI who came by accident, and they heard enough to make it interesting to them, and they researched and they learned and they listened, and first thing you know, they began to come on board to our way of thinking. And I know that there are a lot of people out there, just like they're members of the Klan and lots of other groups, that are good, responsible people. They just have not been given the opportunity to learn the truth. They haven't come across it. And I think that's part of our mission, and that's why we are out here talking. I know it seems most of the time that we're just having a visitation among ourselves, but we need to talk to other people. And if they have the eyes to see and the ears to hear, then that little mustard seed that we plant is going to sprout and grow. But if we do nothing and we don't try to reach out to these other groups of people, I think we're missing a part of the mission that has been given us. Now, I may be wrong, and you can correct me if I am, but that's the way I feel about it. And I think that if we fail to do that, if we turn our backs and say, well, I'm talking to this group or I'm not going to talk to that group, there may be scalawags in that group that we don't want to talk with. But there are going to be some out there that are going to be our people who are waiting to hear the truth. And I firmly believe that's part of our mission. And if someone else has a different thought on that, I would love to hear it. I'd like to hear you speak up and say something. Then I have another comment I want to make after that. But what do y'all think? Am I wrong in this
Well, no, you're not wrong. We do have to have to witness to our brethren every opportunity we could get. And our success rate, I'm telling you, it's not going to be high. You might get 2 to 4% of the people that you talk to might believe you enough to go looking. and the rest are just going to blow you off. I know. That's my success rate is probably 2% with people, guys that I spoke to. And an environment where people were, for the most part, either already racially aware, or if they weren't, they were about to become racially aware real quick. But that didn't mean they all wanted to hear this message.
True. But
you have to...
Them out somewhere.
Well, that's why Tea Parties.
Go ahead.
That's why Tea Parties and events like that are probably they probably are a good way to meet people and to give out pamphlets like the immigration problem in biblical prophecy or Clifton's. They're your children, do you care? And it doesn't even have to be one of my pamphlets or one of Clifton's. And any identity material that's halfway decent, and there's a lot of it out there, and that would be the ideal place to give that stuff out, because at a place like that, you're already meeting people that are aware enough to be looking for something, even if they don't know what it is.
Well, some of my best successes over the years have been people that I really didn't think were going to catch on. But I planted the seeds and I stepped back, and some of them began to start reading and asking questions. And some of my best friends in CI are people who started out that way. So that was my main comment. It's kind of got spurred on by WCB and Sword Brother in their conversation in the chat room. But I kind of agree that, we need to, now we don't need to let the enemy have the forum. But people who are susceptible or who have something to offer, but they may not all agree a point that we believe and agree on. But if there's enough connection there, we can get something good out of it. Now I have another comment I'd like to make, if I may. I've kept out all this time, so y'all give me 5 minutes. I went to a Judeo-Christian church yesterday. It was a First Baptist church, and it was a fairly large one. I was invited. Of course, they had Thanksgiving dinner, and that had absolutely nothing to do with me going. However, it was good. And I was, it's been a long time since I've been in a major church, and I was appalled at the changes that I saw within that church. They had all of the latest technologies, and it was in a smaller town. It wasn't, in a big city, but it was, one of the largest, it was probably the largest church in that town. And, they had teleprompters. They had video cameras. The songs that they sung, they had these two huge screens that had verse by verse as you sang. And people didn't even have to get their books and open them up. And it was just the most organized. I thought I might be in one of these new modern television groups. And these were, they just sat around like a bunch of zombies going through their little motions, and it was a lukewarm environment. The preacher, he was a guest preacher, and he's out on Thanksgiving, on the patriotic part of Thanksgiving. And I thought, well, I can sit through this. It's not going to be too difficult. And then right in the middle of it, he stopped a story. And he told about he was at this church in South Louisiana as a guest pastor, and he said that when they finished, they all went to the fellowship hall and had a dinner. And he said when they got ready to open it with the invocation, bless the food, they looked over and saw this little black boy who had come in and sat at the table, and that somebody asked him if he was going to pray before he's eating, and he says, oh, yes. And so he prayed out loud. And this preacher said that that was the most moving prayer he had ever heard in his life, and that all in the fellowship hall stopped what they were doing and listened to his prayer. And, you know, I thought, well, everybody's going to start breaking out in tears any moment. But it was his way to interject the racial story into his deal. And I don't any more believe that story than the moon. But it was very churchy, and it was very multicultural. And I guess that was the only reason he could bring race into it, because this is a segregated church. But I was appalled at the changes that's happening in these, you know, we see it on television, but to see it in real life. And I attended the men's Sunday school class. They invited me to attend in Sunday school class. I don't know what that was. I think Bill is taking, he's blowing his nose. Anyway, they had their little books, and their books come from this, national organization, and I was thumbing through the Sunday school book, and it was the biggest bunch of gobbledygook I've ever seen in my life. The lesson that we was supposed to be studying was respect. Kids respect their adults, respect the kids, and you respect your boss and so forth and so on. They read four verses out of Ephesians, and the rest of it was talk about hunting and all these other things. And I sat there to myself thinking, I have been here 1 hour, and this is absolutely nothing but trash. And that is Sunday school. And these are senior adults in Sunday school, and I'm thinking, what a loss. And I compare that to a Bible study that we have here at the house every week, and we actually get into some deep study. And that's what's wrong with Judeo-Christians. They have completely and totally been Judaized. And it's amazing. You can't reach these people. They are beyond reach. And so that's why I think we need to reach out, not necessarily within the churches like that, but we need to reach out to those people that are more susceptible. Maybe they are atheists. Maybe they don't understand and accept Christianity. But there's going to be some within them that are going to be malleable, and they're just waiting to get the truth. And that's my point. Well, hush.
Well, you know, I've always had a lot better success with somebody, and it portrays me in as well, myself. But I always had a lot better success in bringing people into the identity message that were already discouraged or disenchanted with mainstream churchianity. And the people that are all caught up in mainstream churchianity, I don't care if you're Catholic, Baptist, or what sect you are, the people that go to church every week, that went to Sunday school, that feel as if they are accomplished in their cult or their religion, those people are practically impossible to reach. Because they know it all. They have that sense of accomplishment that they know everything that they need to know. They know their 10 or 12 little buzzwords or punchlines or whatever you need to call them, whatever they should be called, little one-liners that are responses, canned responses to just about every Bible question. They know those things, and they have that sense of accomplishment. You're never going to convince them that they're wrong, and they're just going to spout all kinds of curses and epithets. Well, most of them don't curse, I could say that for them, but they're going to spout all kinds of blasphemies and slanders at you because they think that you're some kind of devil when you try to tell them the truth about the Bible. I never had any success at all in a captive audience that had to listen to me when I wanted to talk to them. I never had any success at all with the church boys. Never. No matter how decent I was with them, no matter how I approached them, it never, ever worked. They'd rather sing Kumbaya in a room full of Negroes and Puerto Ricans than actually study the Bible. That's the way
it is. Well, you know, I said something about, their Sunday school booklet that they religiously teach out of, and I thumbed through it. And, of course, it is all outlined Sunday by Sunday what you're supposed to read and learn. And there was very little scripture involved in it. It was all get a motivation book out of the library and come up with the same stuff.
But, well, that's what it is. It's psychology. It's not scripture.
Only three people opened their Bible, but not one person referred to anything in time said in the Bible during the entire study. I'm here thinking this is totally, totally wrong. And then one other little thing, I was real, but a young couple, 2 days ago, and the little boy is not even 6 years old. Now, I am not against hunters. I believe that there's a place for hunting. But I believe that if you're gonna, you should, eat what you kill, and you should not go out and just kill for sport. And I realize that we need to thin out, deer and things like, of course, hogs nearly all killed anyway. But, the mother was bragging about how she had given this boy this little BB gun, and I saw him out shooting, and I went out and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'm shooting, the little birds." And I said, "Well, those are little songbirds, you know. Oh, well, you know, I can shoot them." And so I told him, I said, "Well, if I see you shooting any of my songbirds, we will not be friends anymore." So I told Mama that, and Mama said, "Well, I gave him the gun, and I even put up a bird feeder so that he could shoot the birds and learn how to shoot." Now, am I being a prude when I think that is not acceptable? This same little boy was a little boy about 2 months ago, was out with a frog. He beat the frog flat with a hammer. And, you know, that's how Jeffrey Dahmer started. I think we should teach our kids how to shoot for gun etiquette, but we should also ought to responsibility.
Yeah, well, Gerald, I hate to tell you about some of the things we did with frogs and firecrackers when I was a kid.
Oh, I know. Bill, I was young, too. And believe it or not, I was young, too. Now, I did frogs and beat them flat, you know, while they were still living. And, of course, he brought a little pet rabbit over to show me that they had gotten him. And the little rabbit was all blood was coming out of his mouth and nose. And I said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, I was trying to do this with him and teach him that and the other." Well, he was torturing the little rabbit to death.
Yeah, that kid doesn't sound
think
straight.
There's a cruelty there. Now the daddy is a big hunter, and you know, he hunts and fishes, and that's fine. And they want the little boy to grow up and be able to go with dad and shoot ducks, and that's fine. I don't have a problem. Just don't come on my little pond and shoot my ducks that I, you know, come in every year and I feed them and love them and all that sort of thing. But I just find horrible about that. And I asked her, I said, "Well, now what about my little bluebird in spring?" And I got all my little bluebird houses out. And I said, "You know, they come and they raise two families and I feed them and just love them." She says, "Well, you know, if he sees them, he's going to shoot and kill them." And that was her attitude. It was fine. And it bothers me because I love nature, I love God's creation, and I think that there's a time and place to hunt and kill things, and there's a time not to. And I think the little boy is being taught the wrong thing.
Well, yeah, torturing rabbits and pounding frogs flat with hammers shows some antisocial tendencies, I would say. Yeah, that might be a problem later in life.
Exactly. What I was going to say is, you know, the sheriff's departments here all over Louisiana, every parish has them. They have these great classes for young kids, and you can enroll them and teach them proper gun etiquette and how to shoot. And, you know, get the boy target target practice and robins and the marking birds and everything else. You don't just give him a gun and tell him I didn't shoot the – I didn't suggest that. I'm going to suggest that to him like that all over Louisiana because this is sportsman's paradise down here.
That's I would actually commend a mother to bother her son a gun. I think that's a wonderful thing. I mean, you don't hear about that too often anymore.
Exactly.
It's a damn shame every mother in the country don't, every white mother in the country doesn't buy her son a gun.
I agree. But teach him the proper method of using the gun. That's my only
Well, well, of course. That's, yeah, you know, gun ownership comes with responsibility. It always has.
Oh, I'm not coming through clear. Is that what you're saying, Bill?
Well, no, you're not coming through clear, and you don't hear very well because your connection's slow. So you can't hear when somebody else is speaking to you.
Ah.
You know, I know you don't hear me right away when I speak, so it's just not conducive to good conversation, that's all. Those satellite connections are terrible, I know.
Sorry.
You don't have to apologize. I know you don't have anything better. It's not your fault you live out in gator country in the middle of nowhere in a swamp with a Dixie cup and a string for communications. I know that ain't your fault.
Oh, my God.
Well, you know, it's better than living in Nigger or Jew Town, I'll tell you that.
But, well, yeah,
you're right. Give me alligators and...
No, you're absolutely right, Gerald. It's better than a lot of the options you could have, right? I'm sorry to hear you went to the Baptist church. I guess we all have to be reminded of how bad it is once in a while. I'd rather go lay on the railroad tracks myself and wait for a train, but maybe... I'm sure there's a lot of really good people attending those churches, and that's a damn shame, right?
You know, Richtar brings up a point here in
the chat.
Exactly. He said something, and he's kind of saying it sort of in jest, but it's true. He says, best for kids to practice on a live target, nigger, Jew, or Arab is the best. And that's something I've always thought. I'm surrounded by white men who have this sort of weapon and that sort of weapon, and they go deer hunting and duck hunting and dove hunting and this hunting and that hunting, and they'd never think about pointing one of those weapons against one of their racial enemies.
Well, right, and when it comes down to it, they may not be able to, huh?
Yeah.
That's the way it is. Well, we're not supposed to rely on our weapons to get us out of this mess. It's nice to have them and to be able to defend yourself, yes. No matter how many weapons you have, you'll only defend yourself successfully if it's Yahweh's will. And
right.
If it's Yahweh's will, you'll defend yourself successfully without weapons. So that's the way I look at it. But, it's nice to be able to defend yourself. It's nice to be able to win food at a dinner table, but we shouldn't rely on our weapons. And most of us, most of the men I know probably wouldn't be able to shoot somebody if they had to.
No, it's a different psychology from killing an animal, looking a person dead in the eye and pulling the trigger on them. It's not everybody who can do it. And even not if they're scared or pissed off or something, not everybody can do it. So, yeah, Vera, I hope you never have to find out either.
If I could give a bunch of guns away, it'd probably be in the inner city in Philadelphia or Brooklyn or the Bronx.
Yeah. Hey, Bill.
You know what they
you do sound
with
like?
Them.
You sound like you're in the next room, man.
Yeah, I know. I flipped my microphone up. I'm sorry. I said if I could give guns away, I'd give them all away in Brooklyn or the Bronx, right? Or Philadelphia or in the inner city. You know what they'd all do with them?
They'd kill each other.
Immediately. Give them all 10,000 bullets. Well, what else do we have here tonight besides sadistic children in Louisiana and Negroes with guns in Philadelphia?
I've gone 2 hours and 8 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I like to keep this going a little while longer. If anybody has anything to say, just request to talk, and I'll free up your microphone. Oh, no takers, huh? 2 hours might be enough. Well, the suspense is killing me. I think I'll just end it with this. Thanks, everybody, and good night. This is the Chris DeGennier Open Forum, and I'll see you next Monday.